And now, presidential hopeful Donald J. Trump gives us his own assessment of Monday Night Raw.
And then it went on for 3 hours. Happy with it? Unhappy? You think it was productive?
Well, it was a little bit like WWE, the great Vince McMahon. The thing that made me most upset, and everybody else too, was the 3 hours. It was too much, it was too long, and I would imagine at a certain point people get bored with that.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered a streak!
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
Well, we may have finally found 3 hours of television more insufferable than Raw. And it's called the GOP Presidential Debate. Luke forwarded this to me on Twitter. I have to share this. This was the morning after the debate. This is from the Washington Post. Headline, Winners and Losers from the CNN Debate. And the writer says, 3 hours for the main debate. Look, I love politics a lot, but that was and is simply too long. It's asking a massive amount of the candidates, the moderators, and the people watching. 2 hours should be the absolute longest any future debate goes. Sound familiar? I'd say 3 hours is asking a lot of the wrestlers, the writers, and the fans, too. And we have to do this shit every week. Well, I mean, you don't. A lot of you spare yourself the pain and just listen to my review. I want you people to remember that when I mention PayPal and Audible, okay? Just keep that in mind. I got a lot to say about Raw this week, and it's not good. One thing I watched that was better than Raw was the new 12 Rounds movie with Dean Ambrose, which is basically the first Die Hard movie, but without the greatness of Alan Rickman, one of the greatest movie villains in the history of cinema. But for a guy who's never done a movie before, and who agreed to do it thinking he'd only have a cameo, and he had no idea he was actually going to be the lead, I thought Ambrose did a fine job, and I would like to see him do more of these. Starting this week, we are going to be doing something special here on the podcast in celebration of the Sound Off 8-year anniversary, which is coming up on, ironically, November 8th. November 8th. That particular episode will mark the 8-year anniversary, 8 years I've been doing this podcast. We just celebrated 400 episodes, and this is the next milestone coming up. And I thought it would be cool to do a little countdown starting today, because in case you didn't notice, today marks exactly 8 weeks until that November 8th podcast. And so what I'm going to be doing is a countdown of my eight of my favorite WWE matches of all time. I put a list together. I narrowed it down to 8. I intentionally left off, not all, but some of the more obvious ones. Anybody who's listened to the show for any length of time can probably figure out a good chunk of my top 5 or top 10 as far as my all-time favorite matches, or matches that I'm exceedingly fond of. There are some that will be on this list. There are others that I left off because I didn't want it to be overly obvious. And so, again, this is not going to be in any kind of order. I'm not ranking them. You know, number 8 is the least favorite and number 1 is the most favorite. So there's no rank order here, but these are 8 of my favorite matches, most of which, in fact, all but one of which you can find right now on the WWE Network. So the cool thing about it is, you know, I could talk about it here and give a little bit of background on it, what I liked about it, what makes the match so special. And then you can go on the network and you can watch it or rewatch it if you've seen it before. It's going to be one match per week for the next 8 weeks. We're not doing the whole list in one shebang here. We're going to do one match per week leading up to and including that November 8th podcast. So we're going to be starting that this week. It'll be after the mailbag. We'll save that for the end of the podcast. So stick around for that. I think you guys will enjoy that. Keep signing up for Audible. We have our URL still going strong. You can use audibletrial.com/solomonster to sign up for a free 30-day trial of the Audible service. You get one free audiobook with your sign-up that you get to keep no matter what, including the new Daniel Bryan book, among others. So audibletrial.com/solomonster. We had an unbelievable summer with the sign-ups, and we've had a pretty good September so far, so we can strengthen that even more. So if you've already used the link, you know, pass it on to friends and family, maybe if you think they may be interested, whoever you think may be interested, and tell them it's free. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster. And also don't forget we have our store on ProWrestlingTees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off. Over 20 shirts, ship all over the world. You can check those out. And last but not least, if you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so with a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. $30 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out, a quick shout-out for your business, for your YouTube show, your podcast, what have you. So let's run through these shout-outs here, because we had a lot of people who donated this week. I can't thank you guys enough. We have Yvonne Bruiser Balick, Light 'em Up Lamont Ambler, Chuck Lunatic Lentz, Case Closed, Aaron Kloss, The Scottish Assassin, Colin Kerr, Deadpool, James Herrera, Lord Have Mercy, Versi Jones, Arrogant Alex Matthews, Brian Hitman Hurst, Puddle of Blood, as opposed to Puddle of... anyway, John Pudney, The God of Justice, Giovanni Turner, Michete, Alfonso Rojas, The Dark Angel, Ann Hopper, Christopher Scrumdiddly Umptious Garcia. I did not come up with that one myself. Someone is a Willy Wonka mark. Sudden Impact, Jeffrey Matthews, who is attending an open tryout today, as a matter of fact, for the San Antonio Spurs minor league team in the NBA Development League. So good luck to Jeff. And the last outlaw, Andrew Gelinas. You can check out the Valiant Vision Podcast Network on Podbean, Stitcher, iTunes, and they've got shows like Wrestling with Valiance and Surf and Turf, so you can go to valiantvision.podbean.com and check out all that good stuff there. And we also, last but not least, have the Badass Baker, Grizzy Bakes. He's celebrating a birthday today. So let's all wish the Badass Baker a happy birthday. You can follow him on Instagram at Grizzy Bakes. He makes custom pastries for those with a sweet tooth. If you like cakes, if you like cupcakes, and let's be honest, who doesn't like cupcakes? I mean, come on. Give him a look on Instagram. Again, his name on there is Grizzy Bakes. So thank you to everybody who made a donation this week. Again, I can't thank you guys enough. And let's get right into our Night of Champions predictions. The pay-per-view is tonight. From Houston, Texas, we will run the card down here from top to bottom. We'll start with the main event, and we'll work our way downward. Of course, the main event, I don't know if this is going to go on last. I see no reason for it not to. I think it would be kind of dumb for, you know, for example, for them to do Cena and Rollins last. But the WWE Championship match is Sting challenging Seth Rollins. And there's, you know, a lot of people wondering, is Sheamus going to cash in? Is Sting going to get a token run with the title? What's going to happen? Is he going to go, you know, 0-2? Or I guess he would be 1-2 in singles matches if he loses here. But I think Rollins is retaining. Even if Sheamus attempts to cash in, they've mentioned it so many times on TV. Even this morning I saw Sheamus on Twitter was teasing that he was going to cash in. And they've been mentioning that and teasing that as such a possibility. It almost seems too obvious now for them to either do it, or they can attempt the, he can attempt to cash in, but to actually successfully cash in would almost be too obvious to me. But he has been on an awful losing streak on TV, which worries me, because you know what that usually means. I do not want Sheamus as WWE champion. I don't know what it is about the guy. You know, when he's in there with the right opponent, it's not like he can't have great matches. He can. He's actually pretty good. But I just find him incredibly dull. And putting the title on him right now with interest as low as it is these past few weeks with football and everything else, I just think that would be death to put the title on Sheamus. You know, he never even should have gotten the briefcase in the first place. I thought it was a waste of the case. I still do. But Rollins is my pick, especially since I think he's dropping the U.S. title back to John Cena. He's not losing both belts on the same show. Now, what would I like to see happen? Which is a different question. I'm predicting a Rollins win, but what would I like to see happen? I would like to see Sting win the championship. They need to shake things up a bit, and I think it would be nice for them to be able to say that he was not only WCW champion when he goes into the Hall of Fame, which is inevitable, could be as early as next year. But I think they want to be able to promote the fact that he's also a former WWE champion, which you know they would love to be able to do, to promote that fact above all else. It's one of those petty things that I absolutely do not put past this company. So, you know, what the hell do they have to lose at this point? Give him a run. Give him a short run. He can drop it back to Rollins at Hell in a Cell. You know, better yet, they've got this Madison Square Garden house show coming up in a couple of weeks. You don't need to keep the championship on him for more than 2 weeks. You can make the rematch at the MSG show October 3rd. And that way, like I said, he only holds it for a few weeks, and it makes the MSG show feel that much more special. And even though it's airing on the network, it's still a house show. It'd be kind of interesting. I don't remember the last time the WWE title changed hands on a house show. I mean, it may have been when Diesel beat Bob Backlund. That's how far, which ironically was in Madison Square Garden just over a decade ago. I can't even remember the last time the championship changed hands in Madison Square Garden. Was it Punk? I think it might have been when Punk beat Del Rio to kick off his 434-day reign. And instead of having the 56-year-old guy beating Rollins clean to do it, my idea would be Masked Kane. You know, Kane's been ready to come back now for like at least a month, and he's been backstage at the shows. It's only a matter of time. Any week now, he's going to be back on TV. By the time you listen to this, whether it's the pay-per-view or Monday Night Raw, he'll probably already be back if I had to venture a guess. And the last time we saw him, he was writhing in pain on the floor when Brock Lesnar broke his ankle and Seth Rollins stepped on it and walked off. So, for months, they were building the tension between Kane and Seth Rollins. They would make up, and then there would be trouble again, and they would make up, and there would be trouble again. To me, there's really nothing else for you to do with that angle. When Kane comes back, he's got to go after Rollins. And the best way to do so is to screw him out of the championship. So I think it absolutely makes sense. With a Kane assist, you have Sting winning the title. That's what should happen. But I'm still predicting that Rollins retains. We have Seth Rollins against John Cena for the United States Championship. I mentioned before, I think Cena is winning the title back. So he's my pick. Nikki Bella defending her Divas Championship against Charlotte. Or maybe it'll be Brie again. Yeah, wait until I get into that. So the Divas title is on the line, and the stipulation is that if Nikki Bella loses by countout or disqualification, not just pin or submission, she will lose the title. So no shenanigans, or she's done. I'm predicting that Nikki is retaining. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion at all that Charlotte's winning the title. In fact, I don't think she is. I think Nikki retains. Paige is going to attack Nikki, costing Charlotte the match, so it'll be a DQ finish, which means, actually, if there's a DQ finish, well, yeah, okay, so if Paige attacks Nikki, right, that's my line of thinking. If Paige attacks Nikki, then Nikki would win by DQ, not the other way around. So the point is, I've been saying I think Paige is turning, I think they pull the trigger here, and that leads to a PCB breakup, a Paige heel turn. I know some people are hoping the anti-diva Paige returns. I think that ship has sailed, but, you know, they could always do it if they want to, go back to the whole anti-diva thing. So I think this is where it happens, and Nikki retains. And you know what, though? If Charlotte does win, I said this on Twitter, and I'm going to stick to my guns on this. If Charlotte does happen to walk out with the Divas Championship, she needs to take that butterfly belt and put it in the trash where it belongs and bring back her dad's big gold belt. That'd be a great gimmick for her. I'm not saying that's the permanent replacement for the Divas title. It gives them time to work on a new design. But wouldn't that be kind of cool if Charlotte wins the title and she's like, you know, the hell with this piece of garbage, and she drops it in the trash can and takes her dad's old big gold belt, which I always thought was one of the better looking titles. And I'm not even talking about the one the WWE used. That's a different version. I'm talking old school big gold that I'm sure Flair has or has a version of it. Actually, I think Hogan might be in possession of the big gold belt. But in any event, I think that might be a cool little, you know, gimmick for her. She's a Flair. It's not like she shies away from it, so why not just fully embrace it? The New Day defending the tag team titles against the Dudley Boys. I'm going with New Day. I think it's way too early for the Dudleys to win the belts. And it would be a crime to take the belts off New Day prematurely. They already did that once. These guys deserve a longer run because they're fucking awesome. Ryback and Kevin Owens for the Intercontinental Championship. Owens says he's a prize fighter, right? That's his whole gimmick. Or at least it was. I know they kind of disregard things sometimes when guys get called up from NXT. But that's what he's called himself in the past. He fights for something. That's when he's at his best. Ryback's run, to me, has been mediocre. But I think part of that is because they don't have any real plans for the guy. Yeah, it's like he's got the IC title, and I can't envision him then ascending to, you know, wrestling for the WWE Championship. Even though he should get a title shot. Remember, he pinned the champion a few weeks ago. Yeah. Someone should remind WWE of this. But then again, I'm still waiting for Sasha Banks to get her title shot, and she pinned the champion too, so I don't really think that means much in this company. But I'm going with Kevin Owens. I think Kevin Owens is winning. I think he's winning the Intercontinental Championship. Owens, unlike Ryback, I like to think they have big plans for him. And he has a more dynamic personality than simply, I'm the big guy. You know, that works for Ryback, but Owens is just more, there's more to the persona than there is. Ryback is, it's pretty much what you see is what you get. There isn't a whole lot of confusion as to who he is or what he is. So, there's no reason to not put the title on Kevin Owens. He's treading water anyway right now. He's already wrestled Cena. He's already wrestled Orton. It's not like he's going to challenge Rollins next for the championship. He's treading water, I think, until Sami Zayn comes back. I still think Sami Zayn is eliminating Owens from the Royal Rumble as a surprise. I said that months ago on the show, and I'm sticking to that. You know, there's nothing left for Sami to do on NXT. So when he comes back, it should be on the main roster. And you know what? Once Sami comes back, if Owens has the Intercontinental title, now they have something else to feud over. Besides their own personal issues, I know it's not the NXT title, but the Intercontinental title used to be considered the workhorse title in that promotion. And it can be again with those two guys. So I say put the title on Owens now, let him beat a few guys, have a nice run before Sami comes back. The Wyatt family against Dean Ambrose, Roman Reigns, and a mystery partner. Clearly, it's Jey Uso out for revenge for his brother Jimmy. No, I had a feeling it would be Eric Rowan. I did not want it to be Eric Rowan. But I've read that he's still recovering. He's not cleared yet to return. So I think it's pretty safe to say it probably will not be Eric Rowan. Because until I knew that he still wasn't cleared, I thought for sure, okay, it's going to be Rowan, and he's not going to do much in the match, and then at the very end, he's going to turn on Reigns and Ambrose, and he's going to reunite with the Wyatt family, which is where he belongs. But it's going to be one of those kind of deals where he turns on them. So it doesn't look like that's going to happen. I don't think it's Kane, because that wouldn't make any sense, aside from that one segment months ago that almost nobody remembers, where Ambrose was backstage with Kane. Ambrose was stirring shit up between Kane and Rollins. And he was talking to Kane about, you know, finding the demon and bringing back out the demon. I would be stunned if they even remembered they did that segment. You know who I think it may be? And I may look like, you know, a fool, you know, by the time you listen to this. There's a guy down there at NXT that we have not seen on television yet. I don't even think he had his first match until this year. It may have been at one of those NXT shows at Fan Access around WrestleMania time. His name is Dylan Miley. He's a big guy, not as big as Braun Strowman, but still pretty big. I looked up his stats: 6'3", 285 pounds, big guy. Not Ryback, but you know, big guy. You have to see a picture of this guy to understand how freakish he looks. And I say that in a good way, okay, with all due respect. The guy is a freak. You have to see his hands. He has a picture of his hand as his Twitter avatar. If you go to his Twitter page, at Dylan M WWE, it's just a giant hand. You'll see what I'm talking about. One of the things that impressed them the most when they signed him last year, he came in without any prior wrestling experience whatsoever. He just showed up one day for a tryout. One of the things that impressed them was the fact that this guy could do a 3-foot standing vertical jump. For a 6'3", 285-pound guy, that's pretty impressive. So he's definitely got athletic ability. Now, it's way too soon to bring him up to the main roster, but it's not like they haven't brought up guys too early before. I'll give you one name, Braun Strowman. Okay, that's Exhibit A. So it's not like they don't have a pattern of doing that before. Now, granted, people are hoping for a big name. They're talking about The Rock. They're talking about Daniel Bryan or Chris Jericho. So this guy walking out, this Dylan Miley guy, if it is him, guy who we've never seen before, it'd probably get over like a wet fart. But if this guy gets in there and he impresses people within a few minutes, they tag him in, you know, he's not much to look at maybe other than, again, he looks like a freak. But if he starts doing some pretty athletic stuff in there, you know, he may get himself over. It could be a great way to introduce him. You know, Daniel Bryan, look, here's the thing with Daniel Bryan. He's been ready to come back for a couple of months now. He's been waiting on WWE's doctors to clear him. It's entirely possible that he has finally gotten that clearance and they're keeping it hush-hush to make for a bigger surprise. And he may be the third guy tonight. I give it at least 50-50, maybe even a little bit better than 50-50 that it could be Daniel Bryan. I don't think it is, though, but it's possible. I'd think WWE would want a bigger guy in there to go toe-to-toe with Strowman, not somebody Bryan's size, but it's definitely possible. But I'm going with Dylan Miley. I don't see anybody else mentioning his name. He's my dark horse. He's my pick for the third guy tonight. As far as who I think is going to win, I think it's going to be the Wyatt family. The Wyatts have lost, I think, there's been, two matches now, I think, between the Shield and the Wyatts, or the remnants of the Shield and the Wyatts, and I think the Shield has won all of them. I know they won at SummerSlam. Wyatt family has a new guy now. They need some momentum. They have to win this match. We have Dolph Ziggler against Rusev. Matthew sent me a tweet saying these two killed it at the house show in Montreal on Friday night, so hopefully they can duplicate that here, because their last match on Raw a few weeks ago I thought was a bore. But they're both good. I like both of them, and Rusev is Rusev has his moments of greatness. What kind of match they'll have, we'll see. It's a shame, because the original plan, I'm sure, was to do a mixed tag here, and then Lana got hurt. So they had to improvise, and we're getting this match again. I'm going to go with Dolph Ziggler. I just think, you know, it's a lot of, I don't know. It's kind of the story of WWE, right? It almost doesn't even matter. Back and forth. You know, one guy wins, the next guy wins, and whatever. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't even matter. But I'm going to go with Dolph as my pick. And lastly, the pre-show match on the kickoff, Neville and the Lucha Dragons against Stardust and the Ascension. My pick there is Neville and the Lucha Dragons. So that is your card, Night of Champions, tonight on pay-per-view. Which brings us to Raw from this past Monday night, live from Memphis, Tennessee. This was the big season premiere that they loaded up to compete with Monday Night Football. It didn't work. They were up from their low of last week, but they were up a whopping 12,000 viewers, which is nothing. Statistically insignificant difference from the previous week's number. Now, you might think, on the one hand, hey, that's almost a victory, because they went up against two NFL games this week. But that third hour dropped again, like a rock. And that was the hour they promoted a Sting vs. Big Show main event, with Sting wrestling his first match ever on Raw. And it also, sadly, included the Divas title match between Nikki Bella and Charlotte, so that's not a good sign at all. And they had no Labor Day holiday to blame this time. It wasn't much of an excuse the week before either. The numbers are not down that much on Labor Day anyway, but they didn't have that as an excuse this week. They promoted a tag team title match and a Divas title match a week in advance. Sting against the Giant here on Monday Nitro. The only thing missing was an NWO run-in and Tony Schiavone calling it one of the greatest nights in the history of our sport, which it was not. You know, there was a thread on our Facebook page last week asking, who would you rather have on commentary today, Tony Schiavone or Michael Cole? And I don't know that a single person voted for Michael Cole. It's possible. I didn't revisit the thread. I haven't seen it since. It's possible a couple of people said Cole. I didn't see a single person who mentioned Michael Cole's name. They all voted for Tony Schiavone. You do realize that whoever they put in that spot is going to sound exactly the same, having to use all that awful vernacular that they have to use in WWE, and promoting the app, and promoting the network, and promoting the Twitter trends, and the charity stuff. You know, it wouldn't be the same Tony Schiavone that everybody thinks they remember. And it's getting worse. Now, I have to mention this. There's been a lot of talk this week. I know there's been a lot of writing about just the state of WWE, people jumping off the bridge and jumping off the ledge. This jumped out at me during the show. Ryback's promo in the ring before Kevin Owens, actually after Kevin Owens came out too, not just before. Oh my God. I know I'm skipping ahead here, but Ryback came out for a promo with Kevin Owens to build their Intercontinental title match at the pay-per-view. And the dialogue that this guy had to memorize, the WWE universe, you know, I still hate that stuff. It's been going on for so long at this point, it's like, whatever, it's not going away. That WWE universe stuff is bad enough, especially when they bring in an outsider. It's one thing to have their own guys say it and make their own guys look like idiots. It's even worse when they bring a celebrity from the outside and they have to say WWE universe. It's just terrible. But as bad as that is, this guy is standing there, Ryback is, telling Owens, I spoke with the authority earlier today, and at WWE Night of Champions. So here we go again. It's that WWE Fastlane bullshit all over again. At WWE Night of Champions, where every championship must be defended, you will meet me for my WWE Intercontinental title. I mean, who talks like that? Who talks like that? Especially an ass-kicker like Ryback. Of all the people on the roster to have talk like that. I could see the thought bubble coming out of the guy's head with all the lines that he had to memorize. This is why we are never, never going to have another Austin 316 moment. Never. They'll never allow it. It's never going to happen. Roman Reigns did a promo on the show I thought was pretty good, but he was even better backstage. Him and Ambrose were talking to JoJo. They did a video on their YouTube channel where they were teasing who their partner might be, and they were talking about the Great Khali, God forbid, and they were talking about Savio Vega. And he was so much more likable, Roman was. I mean, Ambrose was cool. Ambrose is always cool, but Roman was so much more likable in that video. As good as he was on Raw, he's even better in this stupid YouTube video. I don't think there's been a time where promos, overall, were as bad as they are today in WWE. This has to be the worst that I've ever seen. Has to be. Even with the really great ones they sneak in there from time to time, it's as bad as it's ever been. And there are going to be people who say, well, you have a short memory. You know, the 80s weren't so great. If you go back and watch those promos, they're so hokey. You know what, though? It worked for that era, and I disagree with that. Yeah, there were hokey promos, but there were also a lot of really funny and a lot of really great promos back then. You know, the style of promo that Hulk Hogan used to cut in 1989 worked for that era. Hulk Hogan, when he was on his A-game back then, was actually a hell of a promo. Randy Savage, coked out of his fucking mind he looked like half the time. One of the best promo guys ever. I would take a Randy Savage promo over this shit any day of the week. Ultimate Warrior? Well, Ultimate Warrior was Ultimate Warrior. It worked for him. So, yeah, you could say, well, back then it's not like promos were great. It's all a matter of perspective. This is what they call the reality era, right? And that's the thing that's missing. I watch these promos and I listen to these promos. There is not a goddamn ounce of reality in anything that these people are saying. None. There's no reality on the show at all. You would think, if anything, that it would be, you know, less scripted to make it more realistic for the so-called reality era. I laugh when people call this the reality era. Like, what reality are we talking about here? Some warped reality? It's not my reality. And that's one of the biggest problems, I think, that I have with WWE right now. It's painful. It's painful to watch these guys talk. That used to be one of the more fun parts of the show, and you're never going to get that again. Unless they change their ways, and they're set. They do things the way they do it, and that's just how it is. But as long as they insist on doing that, we're going to get promos like that Ryback one. And I can only blame, I mean, Ryback is not a great promo, but it's only his fault up to a point. You got to give these guys some help. It's not all their fault. They can only do what they can do with what they're given, you know? So I just thought that was atrocious. Just absolutely fucking atrocious. But to go back to Sting wrestling for a second, I liked it. I liked the fact that they had Sting wrestle on this show. I didn't expect it to go long. It didn't. And normally I'd say, oh, you know, why use Sting on TV when you can use him to get people interested in your pay-per-view and subscribe to the network? But you know what? This three-hour format for Raw, it has broken me. It has finally broken me. When they said that Sting was wrestling on Raw, I said, great. Finally. Something different. Believe it or not, Sting represents something different on this show. 56-year-old Sting, who's been doing this for 30 years, represents something different on this show because we've never seen it before. We've never seen him wrestle a match on Raw before. I want to see more of that. I want them guns blazing, doing everything in their power to keep my interest. I know they have a pay-per-view to promote every month. These shows are basically three-hour advertisements for those pay-per-views. But I don't care. Make the shows fun again. Do whatever you have to do. All hands on deck. You've got Sting under contract? Fucking use him. You've got Brock Lesnar under contract? Fucking use him. Promote a big Raw match for Brock every now and then. Shake things up. It has to be done. Just make it fun again. You know, Trump, you heard Trump at the beginning of the podcast, right? Trump says he wants to make America great again. He's got his little fucking hats and all that shit. Make America great again. That's all I ever hear the guy saying. Well, you know what? I want WWE to make Raw great again. That's what I want. Because at this rate, this is what Raw is going to look like. Next week, another meaningless six-man tag team main event.
1.6.
The week after that, John Cena versus The Big Show.
0.2.
And finally, the return of Randy Orton against Sheamus.
0.0.
Those are going to be your ratings. That may be the only way to get their attention, since apparently that's the only thing they care about. Almost every single match on this show had some kind of fuck finish, be it a DQ or a distraction or just no match at all. I think the only two matches that ended clean were Cena against Sheamus and the Cena-Sting tag team match, which was born out of a fuck finish in the Big Show-Sting match. Cena versus Sheamus, as soon as I saw this match was next, I flipped over to Nitro. And Nitro hasn't even been on the air in 14 years. So I didn't see any of this. Cena won. No, really, I know it's hard to believe, but he did. The Money in the Bank curse continues for Sheamus. New Day beat the Primetime Players to retain the tag team titles. Titus was distracted by Xavier playing the trombone. He got pinned with their finish. Dudleys came out. They screamed a lot to hype their match at the pay-per-view, and that was it. Ric Flair was shown backstage with his daughter, Charlotte, talking about her championship match tonight. Flair looked like he was trying so hard not to look into the camera. Like there was something, like Vince McMahon himself was standing with him at gunpoint, off camera, telling him, don't look in the camera, don't look in the camera, whatever you do. This guy was, he was fighting it. He looked into it a couple of times, but he was fighting the urge not to look into the camera. It's just, it's so counterintuitive, though, to what this guy has done his entire career. I can just picture him when the segment ended, like, grabbing the camera, even though it was off, and cutting 15-minute promos into it just to get it all out of his system, you know? Like a cat. Any cat owners out there will know what I'm talking about. If you hold down a cat's tail long enough and you let go, they'll whip that fucking thing around like crazy once you let go. It's kind of that concept. By the way, thoughts with Kevin Castle. Somebody told me his cat is apparently really sick, which is terrible. I've had my cat now 14 years, and I worry about that all the time. You know, as the animals get older, naturally you worry about that. So I just think that's awful. So Sasha Banks beat Paige 5 minutes 17 seconds with the bank statement. Nice little match. Not long enough. Yet again, Team Bad gets involved and helps Sasha win, while Becky does nothing to help Paige. Yet another loss for Paige. A Paige turn is coming, one way or another. It has to be. Hey, that's pretty cool, actually. A Paige turn. I see what I did there. And I didn't even mean to do it. The Wyatt family appeared on Miz TV. Miz assured everybody that he would not be Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose's partner at Hell in a Cell. Idiot. Well, he's technically right, I guess. Reigns and Ambrose came out. Roman Reigns cut one of his best TV promos to date. He said Jimmy Uso is family, and he's going to get revenge for what the Wyatts did to him on SmackDown last week. Somebody should tell Roman that if it happened on SmackDown, it didn't happen. He said they found themselves a partner, but did not tell us who it would be, and then the segment just ended. No fight, no nothing. A far cry from the days when the Shield and the Wyatt family went to war whenever they set foot in the ring together. I miss those days. Ryback was out next for his painful promo. He was interrupted by Kevin Owens, who had a copy of the book The Secret with him. Maybe they have the secret to good booking in there. Ryback has said he used it as a form of inspiration to come back from all of his injuries and setbacks in his career. You can download The Secret, by the way, just as an aside, using our Audible URL, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Cheap plug. I'm surprised the Ryback can read. I would have thought an audiobook is more up his alley. But anyway, Owens, perhaps with Vince McMahon in his ear, said only weak, stupid people would read a book like that, which is exactly the sort of thing I could imagine Vince McMahon would say about a book like that. Ryback then went into his horrible WWE speak. You know, parrots are pretty smart creatures. I bet if you tried to train a parrot to speak the way someone would talk on this show, it would tell you to go fuck yourself and fly away. Stardust came out with the Ascension for a singles match against Neville, who came out with the Lucha Dragons. And they each had Lillian Garcia announce their name and everything, like she would ordinarily do for, you know, an actual match. And then, no match. All six guys brawled for about 30 seconds, if that. Stardust and the Ascension bailed, and they said there would be a six-man tag on the kickoff show tonight. Stardust and the Ascension call themselves Cosmic Wasteland, so that made this a galactic waste of time. And you know, I was thinking about this. The way the Ascension are dressed and painted up, looking like two guys on the indies doing their best LOD impersonation, and not very good either. And when you consider how these guys are booked on TV, when they're actually booked on TV, they're not the Legion of Doom. They're the Legion of Losers. So instead of LOD, it's LOL. That's my new acronym for them. That's the acronym everybody should start using for them. It's not LOD, it's LOL for these guys. I think that sums up their run pretty well. We got a Nikki Bella promo package before her big title defense, asking all of us, how did you spend your year? She said she spent hers starting a Divas Revolution, which is actually true. You could argue that Nikki Bella did, in fact, help start the Divas Revolution. It's not far-fetched at all. People grew so revolted by her title run and the lack of title defenses that they begged for change. Like Virgil in the New York City subways. They screamed for new faces to be brought up, and they were. We got Charlotte, we got Sasha, we got Becky. I don't know that that would have happened the way it did were it not for people being so thoroughly disgusted by this woman's title reign. So you could say that Nikki Bella did indeed begin a Divas Revolution in WWE, but for all the wrong reasons. So we had Come On Nikki against Charlotte. 11 fucking times Bree shouted that, by the way. They may as well just change Nikki's name to Come On Nikki at this point, because that's all I hear. My prediction was that Paige gets involved for the inadvertent DQ, and Nikki would break AJ Lee's record. Nikki did break AJ Lee's record, but it was with a far inferior finish than the one that I suggested. I didn't like this at all. And this has been the subject of a lot of, divisiveness maybe would be the right word for it. I mean, a lot of, at least on our Facebook page, some people thought it was a great finish, and it's a great way to get people invested in the rematch on the pay-per-view. I totally disagree. At least, ordinarily, under normal circumstances, I would say, yeah, you're right. But I certainly don't feel that way about this match tonight. And I know I'm not the only one. This Twin Magic shit has got to go. Brie ran in for Twin Magic. Charlotte rolled her up, got the pin, 10 minutes into seemingly win the championship. Ric Flair ran down to celebrate. Sadly, he did not take his jacket off and deliver an elbow drop. I was waiting for that. Mother Hen's music played. Out she came. Stephanie said that it's her job to make sure the integrity of the Divas division is maintained. That may have been the greatest comedy line ever scripted in the history of Raw right there. Kudos to whoever put that in there. They should win a fucking Emmy for that line alone. She confirmed to the referee what had happened with the Twin Magic finish, and said that, really, the moment Brie interfered, it should have been a DQ. So, Charlotte is the winner. However, the championship cannot change hands on a DQ, and so therefore, still Divas champion, Come On Nikki. So, adios AJ Lee. They got what they wanted. And, you know, hey, it's not like I'm upset over it. I predicted it. She was going to break the record. Everybody did. It wasn't a huge surprise that Nikki Bella broke the record. It doesn't make me the amazing fucking Kreskin. It wasn't even just that I thought it would happen. I actually pitched an idea where it happened. So how could I be upset? I'm not upset that she broke AJ Lee's record. I don't give a shit. So it's not that I hated the fact that she broke the record. What I hated was that finish that they went with. Not to mention all this stuff with the record completely overshadowed the title itself, to where the match tonight feels like an afterthought. If they can get good heat for the match tonight, then good for both of these women. Because I don't think that's going to be an easy thing. Stephanie said Nikki would have to defend her title against Charlotte at the pay-per-view, and if Nikki lost by DQ or countout, she would lose her title. Here's another reason why I hated this finish so much. And I don't want to hear, oh, you're nitpicking, because this isn't a nitpick. And if you think it is, then you're part of the problem with this product. I've got to thank Fat Jesus on Twitter for reminding me about this. He got the date wrong. It was actually Extreme Rules 2012, which I remember because that was one of the better pay-per-views that WWE has put on in the last, I don't know, however many years. On that show, Nikki Bella defended the Divas title against Layla. They used twin magic for the finish in that match, too. Layla pinned Brie, even though Brie was not officially in the match. And Layla won the title. No one came out to reverse the decision or restart the match. There was no dusty finish where they took the title off Layla the next night on Raw. She dropped the title many, many months later to Eve Torres. And it's that lack of consistency, not just with the twin magic finish, but WWE in general, I think, that leads to the apathy a lot of fans have toward this kind of stuff now. They just make the rules up as they go along. Remember that one time it was a Del Rio match on pay-per-view, and Mike Chioda watched a replay of something that had happened on a flat-screen monitor they had at ringside. There was some controversial finish, and they huddled him around this flat panel to watch the replay, and I think he either the match continued or he reversed the decision. Since when does the referee watch a replay of the finish on a screen at ringside and then change the decision? Because they thought it would be a unique finish. And they proceeded to never do it again. We didn't see that monitor again until last year when it exploded in Dean Ambrose's face. So we're not talking one example or two examples. That would be nitpicking. It's a pattern of this shit that over time makes people not give a shit. And by the way, to the people in the Facebook group, and it's a select few that this is directed at, you need to tone it down with all the Diva posts before I start deleting all of them. Okay, it's completely embarrassing to see some of the behavior on there. And we have women on there, believe it or not, God only knows why. But I'm glad they're there. And some of the things that are said about them in their own posts when they post stuff, if I were their father, you'd get an anvil dropped on your nuts. Okay, so let's show some respect. From now on, if I see something I think crosses a line, you get blocked. No warning, no nothing. I'm not a cop. I don't have to give you an explanation or read you your rights first. You have no rights. Just be respectful. Rusev against Cesaro. Here's another great topic for me to talk about. Rusev is the one with a match on pay-per-view tonight, but Cesaro really needed a win to get back on track. He won, but it was the worst kind of win, where he literally vanished out of sight right after the match ended. Just a complete afterthought. They even played Dolph Ziggler's music at the end of the segment instead of Cesaro's. And even though if it happened on SmackDown, it didn't happen, as the icing on the cake, they have the Big Show pin Cesaro on SmackDown with a knockout punch. So, in fact, the idea was never to feud the two of them, as I thought maybe it was. You know, I did that whole column on TJR Wrestling about Cesaro, and maybe the idea was when they had the Big Show just randomly knock him out a few weeks ago after the match with Miz, they were going to lead to something and put Cesaro over strong against the Giant. Well, no, that was never the idea. The idea, I guess, was to start making the Big Show look strong before his match with Brock Lesnar at Madison Square Garden. So even when I try to give them the benefit of the doubt and try to understand some sense of logic behind what they do, I end up looking like a complete idiot. But not as big of an idiot as Cesaro. So at least they've established him now as mid-card for life, which is what they've done to about 85% of their roster. I just created a new faction for them to use. Take Cesaro and Dolph Ziggler and Wade Barrett and the countless others they've fucked over with start and stop pushes and call them mid-card for life. MFL. Why watch the NFL when you can watch 3 hours of the MFL every Monday night? You can even rearrange the letters in MFL to give you FML, which can be their official catchphrase. Fuck my life. And you know what? They'd probably get more over with that idea than they would any idea that WWE would come up with for them. So feel free to use it. So the match, I don't even care. I mean, does it even matter? Ziggler walked out during the match with a little gift box for Summer Rae, which she did not accept. So Dolph left it on the announce desk for her. Rusev was distracted by all of this, and Cesaro used a roll-up for the pin. Distraction roll-up number 17 on the year, by the way, for Monday Night Raw. Backstage, Cesaro, or Rusev, I should say, stormed into his dressing room, although Cesaro probably did the same thing, let's be honest. Summer stayed behind in the hallway, opened the gift box. I forgot to mention she did grab the gift box after the match, before they left ringside. She's a woman. You knew that she was not going to walk away from that gift. She opened it up. It was some kind of bracelet. Rusev yelled at her to come inside, and off she went. I do like misogynist Rusev more than racist Rusev, I will say that. For the first time in 5.5 years, since a match with Rob Van Dam during Impact's very short-lived stint on Mondays, Sting wrestled a match on a Monday night. He looked good for the 90 seconds that this lasted before Rollins ran in for the DQ. Rollins and Big Show beat up on Sting until John Cena ran down to make the save. Triple H turned it into a tag team match, playa. Rollins and Big Show against Cena and Sting. At one point during the match, Big Show said to John Cena, "This is just like old times." Old times? Old times? That would imply an end. Old times. Big Show doing his stand-up comedy routine mid-match. Cena sold forever, just got beaten down and beaten down until finally he made the hot tag to Sting, who came in a house of fire. He ran wild. Cena gave Big Show an AA. Rollins went to give Cena a pedigree, but Sting grabbed his head from behind and dropped him with what Michael Cole referred to as a scorpion. A scorpion what? We were never told. Maybe he saw an actual scorpion crawling across his papers and screamed. Sting put him in the deathlock, and Rollins tapped out immediately, so Sting gets his first and second win in WWE on the same night. They may be the only wins he ever gets. So that's your Raw review. I didn't like this show, in case you couldn't tell. Real quick, some Tough Enough updates. This comes per the Wrestling Observer. Josh and Sarah Lee have moved to Orlando. They're now training at the Performance Center, but interestingly enough, Amanda, who was the runner-up, has been signed, and she is taking Naomi's place on the next season of Total Divas. I've seen pictures on Instagram of Amanda and Eva Marie. What a combo. What a heat-seeking combo that's going to be. And ZZ has been signed. For people wondering what the hell happened to him, all the times that the coaches and everybody would just rail on this guy and rail on this guy, and he's got no heart, he doesn't get himself in shape, it's disrespectful, this and that. They signed him to a contract. And yet, Gigi and Mata remain unsigned. I don't really know what to say about that, but that's your Tough Enough updates.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT show open with Tyler Breeze out for a match with Adam Rose, who is no longer the life of the party. His new gimmick is Debbie Downer from SNL. He said the WWE Universe had taken a big, hot, steaming poop on him, and now he was going to do the same to NXT. And to be fair, it was the WWE creative team that took a big, hot, steaming poop on Adam Rose, not the fans. They had their chance after that ESPN special, and they blew it. What else is new? Bull Dempsey came out, now a super babyface, surprise, surprise. He asked Adam Rose to let him wrestle Tyler Breeze after what Breeze did to him last week. Rose called Dempsey tubby and slapped him, and so Dempsey beat him up and threw him out of the ring. Tyler Breeze attacked Bull Dempsey from behind, and Bull fought him off. Breeze fled. Next week, they will have a match. The Perfect 10, Ty Dillinger, pinned Danny Burch. Not much to it. It was every Superstars or Wrestling Challenge job match you would have seen back in the day, but with worse commentary. I like it, though, because it gives guys a chance to get their own moves over, so we should have more matches like this, especially on the main shows. Not a lot of them. Again, I want those shows to be fun, but that doesn't mean you can't do a match like this every now and then. We got a vignette for Asuka. So thank you to everybody who corrected me on the pronunciation. It's not Asuka. It's Asuka. She was standing in the ring in an empty Full Sail wearing a mask, and she slowly pulled it off to reveal her face. This is Kana, by the way. I mentioned last week they signed her to a contract. She debuts this Wednesday. I don't know if it's a match or if it's a contract signing or an interview or what, but she debuts this Wednesday on NXT. And we have, you know, Nia Jax is coming soon. It's good. It's good to get some new female talent on TV not named Eva Marie. Apollo Crews pins Solomon Crow with his very impressive standing moonsault. Another loss for Crow. Another step closer to the edge. The heel turn is coming. And it's the best thing for him. What happens after they turn him, though, is anyone's guess. You know, the guy has talent, or else he wouldn't be there. He was one of those, you know, indie guys that people were hoping WWE would sign, and he's the one that just has not panned out so far. There's just something missing, and maybe it's a heel turn. I don't know. I kind of thought he debuted as a heel. Maybe he didn't. I saw him as a heel. People were cheering him, but and that didn't work. I don't know if this will work. I hope for his sake it does. It's my namesake on the line here, man. He's disrespecting my name. Come on. Kyle Edwards made his NXT debut back in the Stamford Studios, running down the latest brackets in the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic. For those who don't know, Kyle Edwards is Arta Ocal, who used to work for The Score in Canada talking wrestling. He was also working with JBL on his Layfield Report website when I used to write there. And as chronicled on here, that didn't turn out too well. That was probably the last time I actually talked to Arta, but I'm happy to see him on TV. You know, living the dream. Good for him. Here's where things stand in the Dusty Rhodes Tournament. Coming up, we have Samoa Joe and Finn Balor against Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy. That should be fun. Dash Wilder and Scott Dawson against the Vaudevillains. And the Hype Bros against Jason Jordan and Chad Gable. Rhino and Baron Corbin wrestled Tommaso Ciampa and Johnny Gargano in a second round match here on this week's show, and it was quite good. Remember last time I said Gargano looked a lot better than Ciampa? Well, this week they both look good. Real good in there. Great chemistry between the two of them. They got a ton of offense in this match, mostly on Rhino before they got cut off. Corbin caught Gargano with the End of Days for the win. Sad to see him go. I don't believe they have deals. In fact, Gargano was back on Twitter after the show aired saying, hey, if anybody wants to book me and Tommaso together as a team, you can email me here. So they're taking bookings. It's good for them, though, because they were on, you know, television, at least on the network. And it gives them added exposure, or maybe they can, up what they charge, maybe on the indies. So it's great for them. It looks like they were just in for the tournament. I kind of like that. It's like the old territories. You bring in some outside talent to work a few shots, and then they move on. But for their sake, though, I hope they impressed enough people, or at least the right people, to get another look. I think they earned it. We learned that this Wednesday, Blake and Murphy are invoking their rematch clause against the Vaudevillains for their tag team title shot. If only Bret Hart could have invoked his rematch clause against Shawn Michaels after WrestleMania 12. Maybe he wouldn't have been so whiny when he came back. Bayley made her very first appearance as the NXT Women's Champion to a raucous reaction from the crowd. She celebrated with the fans. She ran into the fans, up into the bleachers. She came back down. She brought Izzy into the ring. Izzy is a little girl that shows up now at every NXT show dressed up just like Bayley, with the pigtails. And then Bayley wrestled Sarah Dobson, who is better known on the indies as Crazy Mary Dobson, who is in fact crazy if you look up some of her stuff. Bayley did, by the way, wrestle her, not Izzy. I feel like I should correct myself there. Made it sound like Izzy wrestled her. That would not be good for Izzy. Dobson, like Gargano and Ciampa earlier, got a lot of offense in, but in the end, Bayley beat her with the Bayley to belly suplex, And what followed was a perfect example of why I love NXT so much and why I get so goddamn frustrated when I watch the women on Monday Night Raw. Bayley goes to speak. She's interrupted by Sasha Banks. Sasha said that she was there to congratulate Bayley. Bayley earned her respect at TakeOver, which I'm happy she said, because if she would have come out here to just rant and rave like a heel about how Bayley screwed her and it was a fluke, it would have made no sense given the whole horsewomen celebration after the match. So I'm glad that she, you know, talked about how you earned my respect and that kind of stuff. And Sasha said that all she's heard is that their match in Brooklyn was the match of the year, which then got match of the year chants. Sasha said their match was the best women's wrestling match that this company has ever seen, which I've said before. It's hard to argue. Sasha said that it was all well and good, except she lost, and she's here to be the best women's wrestler. I think she said female wrestler that there is. Note the emphasis on wrestling, which is actually allowed on this show. She says Bayley is good. She is not the boss, though. And Bayley accepted the rematch before Sasha could even challenge her to one. She said, "You want a rematch, sister? You got one." And Sasha said she didn't just want a regular match. Bayley said, "Fine, what do you want? 2 out of 3 falls?" Fans could kind of sense what was coming. They started an Iron Woman chant. Sasha said, "I don't want to just beat you once. I want to beat you again and again and again." And Sasha looked like she was on the verge of tears during parts of this whole promo, like where she was talking about their Brooklyn match, but she kept it together. This brought out William Regal, who said he saw a great opportunity here, and he announced that their match would take place at the next TakeOver special, which is called TakeOver Respect, on October 7th. The women would be the main event, and the people went nuts for that when Regal mentioned that. But he was not finished. He said that at TakeOver, it would be a 30-minute Iron Man match. And people went crazy. I'm still calling it an Iron Maiden match, even if they don't want to. And to end the show, both women shook hands, and they had giant smiles on their faces. And they weren't the only ones. I had a huge smile on my face, too. This was perfect. This was perfect. This was everything it needed to be. They perfectly set the match up. They got people amped up for it. No forced dialogue, no cheap attack from behind, just a mutual show of respect in front of an audience that respects them right back. It's become increasingly clear to me that that's just not something we're ever going to see on Monday nights. Vince McMahon doesn't watch this show. He was backstage at TakeOver in Brooklyn. He shook hands with the women when they walked back through the curtain. And if he could watch that match in Brooklyn and the post-match and not be moved to make some kind of change with the way they booked the Divas on Raw, then he's never going to change, no matter what. No matter what anybody says, he will never change. And the buck stops with him, so what he says goes. It doesn't matter if the writers, or Michael Hayes, or Pat Patterson, or Triple H, or any of those people want to make change and are in favor of change, change lies with the boss. And I'm not talking Sasha Banks. I'm talking Vince McMahon. The closest thing to a Divas Revolution is happening on NXT. And you know what the best part about it is? I don't need to sit there and listen to the announcers talk about it. It speaks for itself. TNA. No shortage of great content here for me to discuss on the show this week. We're just kind of rolling along here. Dixie Carter did an interview with Sports Illustrated. And Delusional Dixie, at it again. I always love when Dixie Carter gives interviews because it guarantees me at least 15 to 20 minutes of material on this show. So first, some news that actually came out of this. The writer of the story, or of the interview, the interviewer, confirmed that indeed Destination America would no longer be airing Impact in 2016, at least after February of 2016. That's what Dixie said. We are contracted to Destination America through the end of the year, and we are in ongoing discussions for 2016. That's what she said. So it sounds like the two sides may have reached some sort of agreement that allows TNA to stay on the air a few extra months until they find a new home somewhere else, which is exactly what Spike TV did for them last year. You know, they gave them time to make a deal with somebody else, which turned out to be Destination America. And now history is repeating itself. Only difference is, TNA is in a much weaker position now than they were a year ago, and their television audience is less than half of what it was on Spike. It's also worth noting that D-Max, which aired Impact in Germany and in Austria, is no longer airing Impact. It has been canceled. So they continue to be booted off various stations overseas by Discovery. She talked about her relationship with Jeff Jarrett and the recent angle that just concluded, I believe, with Global Force Wrestling. I think it wrapped up on TV this past week with the big Lethal Lockdown match for Jarrett's shares in the company. Jeff Jarrett legitimately did still have a minority stake in TNA, and it turns out a big part of the agreement between the two sides in making this deal happen was that TNA would allow GFW to get exposure on their TV, and in exchange, Jeff Jarrett would completely divest himself of TNA. Once and for all, 100% out, gone. So they really wanted him out of the picture. You know, maybe as a way to tidy things up a bit for a future sale to a new buyer, right? You could always hope. Maybe, again, I'm just speculating on that. But there's still clearly bad blood there between Jeff Jarrett and Dixie Carter. I said the night that he showed up back on Impact and they showed them embracing backstage, remember they were hugging? I said, check to make sure that neither one of them has a knife in their back. So with GFW losing, they lost the Lethal Lockdown. That officially marks the end of any connection that Jeff Jarrett has to TNA. Some other Dixie quotes. Priceless Dixie quotes. She tried to explain the stories of talent not being paid on time by saying this. She said, "Our accounting is in Dallas, and we're changing and shifting that to Nashville. It's not a matter of not having the money, and it's happened maybe a couple of times at most in 13 years. It's not a function of not having money, so we're trying to simplify the issue and bring accounting to Nashville." Now, it is true that TNA is shifting its accounting to Nashville from Dallas. I think PW Insider broke that story a couple of months ago. Now, Dallas is where Panda Energy is based, so it's very interesting that they are shifting from Dallas to their home base in Nashville. Makes you wonder what that means as far as the Panda Energy connection to TNA is concerned, if they're moving things out of Dallas. But she's just flat out not telling the truth when she says that it's happened maybe a couple of times at most in 13 years. That's just not true. That's just not true. You know, there's been too many reports from, you know, credible sources. Because TNA guys go to the so-called dirt sheets. They go to these websites. They go to the newsletters when they don't get paid or they get paid late. Or nobody is telling them a goddamn thing. All they can do is go to a Wade Keller or a Mike Johnson or a Dave Meltzer and say, "Hey, do you know what's going on? Because they ain't telling us shit." So lots of credible sources have reported a hell of a lot more than a couple of times in 13 years. It's been more than a couple of times in the last year, let alone the last 13 years, that there's been problems with pay. So she's just lying through her teeth. And them moving offices from Dallas to Nashville should have absolutely nothing to do with paying your employees on time. It is a cop-out. Now, in regards to WWE, she says this: "I do feel we've taken some unfair blows. Competition, no matter who it is healthy," which is true. "It's absolutely imperative for the industry to grow. There's a reason there is a Lowe's on the corner of every Home Depot and a Walgreens across from every CVS. Now, in her defense, here where I am in Brooklyn, they actually did build a Lowe's in the lot right next to a Home Depot, as stupid as that sounds. I did find the analogy amusing, though, as if, you know, WWE is Home Depot and TNA is Lowe's. It's more like WWE is Home Depot and TNA is Tom's Tool Shed. I think that's a more apt analogy here. But then came the coup de grace. This was the mother of all quotes. On all of the ex-WWE names that that went to TNA and ended up back in WWE, this is what Dixie Carter had to say. "We've had some of the biggest names ever on our show. People have given us a hard time about using WWE talent, but after a hot run with us, almost every one of them has worked with WWE again. That is a huge compliment for us." You want to know what the best thing about that quote is? Reeks of such delusion that I don't even have to talk about everything that's wrong with it. You know everything that's wrong with it. It speaks for itself. And I'll tell you what, when this TNA thing is done, Dixie may have herself a career in comedy. I didn't even mention the part where she still thinks she's got a shot at signing CM Punk if this whole MMA thing doesn't work out for them. How they outlasted WCW, I'll never know. I will just never be able to figure it out. It's not like WCW didn't have a shitload of money behind it. I just don't get it. I didn't have a chance to watch Ring of Honor this week. I just did not have time. I know they had a pay-per-view on Friday night. Jay Lethal retained both of his championships, which is something I don't believe Seth Rollins will do tonight. I guess we'll find out in a few hours. I do want to mention this, though, and I posted this on Facebook. This past week, on the 16th, actually, was 9 years to the day of probably the greatest wrestling show that I ever saw live, which was Ring of Honor Glory by Honor 5. Night 2. It was divided into two nights. And this was the second one. It was at the Manhattan Center. They had a main event of Bryan Danielson. You may know him. Against Kenta for the ROH title. Hell of a main event. Nigel McGuinness against Naomichi Marufuji for the GHC heavyweight title. They had the Kings of Wrestling against Austin Aries and Roderick Strong for the tag team titles. Bruno Sammartino made what was at that time a very rare appearance. He had a lot of respect for the ROH product because it was such the polar opposite, more so even back then, to what WWE was. And Bruno was still on bad terms with WWE and had no communication with them and didn't like what Vince had done to wrestling. So Bruno got in the ring and he cut a promo and was very respectful to ROH and all of its talent. The talent was surrounding the ring like lumberjacks, just to listen. They were hanging on the guy's every word. It was cool to actually be there for, Bruno's appearance. So I posted pictures. I actually took pictures on my disposable camera. This was before my BlackBerry, which actually I got my BlackBerry in 2008. So this is even older than that. I went to this show a year before I started doing this podcast. That's how long ago it was. And I can't believe it's been almost a decade. But there's some pictures I posted on Facebook if you want to check them out. The ones that I still have, I posted up there. Let's get to the mailbag and your questions. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. TheSolemnMonster@gmail.com. We'll start with David from Sacramento. Is Bayley Sasha Banks worth going a third match after TakeOver? Have Sasha win the Iron Maiden match and then lose a rematch as the tiebreaker. By doing this, you squeeze out one more legendary match. I just see Sasha Bayley as the end of women being the showcase of NXT. Sure, a new wave is coming in, but the era of the four horsewomen is lightning in a bottle. No, you know, I just think it becomes the law of diminishing returns, you know, the more you do something. And I think they're going to go out there, they're going to wrestle for 30 minutes, unless they go to a draw and then they go into sudden death overtime. They're going to wrestle 30 minutes. It's hard to top that. I mean, you could come back and do a cage match or something like that. I don't see that happening. And I don't think it should happen. You know, Sasha's been moved to the main roster for better or worse. That's where she is. And so she's doing, you know, some of the residual NXT matches here and there. Kevin Owens even, right? He had his rematch against Finn Balor, and he hasn't been back on NXT since. And I think it'll be the same way here. Sasha will lose again. And that will probably be the end of her on NXT, which is sad. But you've got to move on. At some point, you've got to move on, and you can't just keep rematching them over and over and over again. Alex from Cleveland. I wanted to know your opinion of the Main Event Mafia. Although they were mishandled by TNA Creative, I thought they were an awesome faction and had the potential to do great things. Everyone in that group reinvented themselves to a certain degree, especially Sting, who to my knowledge had never appeared in a suit and tie before with sunglasses and no makeup. He also became a heel, although towards the end of their run, he shifted toward being a tweener. Also, had the faction been created by WWE, do you think they would have succeeded? Well, yeah, I'm sure they would have succeeded just because they would have gotten a huge push. You take four or five main event level guys and put them in a group, they're going to get so much television time, they're going to just suck up the oxygen from everybody else. So yeah, I'm sure they would be successful, probably at the expense of everybody else. It was a cool concept. I don't recall hating on the Main Event Mafia. I hated on Aces and Eights. I thought Aces and Eights was among the worst factions in wrestling history. But not even necessarily the idea of it, but just the execution and the guys they use and the way they were booked. You know, remember, at the in the early stages of the Aces and Eights, I know I'm going off topic here a little bit, they lost like every match they were in. It's kind of like the Nexus in WWE. They were going great for a while, and then they hit a wall. Named Cena. So, you know, at that point, who could take the Aces and Eights seriously? The Main Event Mafia, though, was definitely better than Aces and Eights. You know, you mentioned Sting being a heel. I think part of the problem was, I don't ever remember Sting in that storyline. I don't really ever remember Sting being a heel. Because, from what I can remember, every time there was a Main Event Mafia attack on a babyface, I think Sting just kind of faded into the background and didn't partake in the attack. It was almost like he didn't want to. Almost like they were afraid, or maybe he was afraid, to be booked as a heel. Sting never should have been a heel in the first place. That was completely stupid. At least the first time they tried it. I mean, I know later on came Joker Sting. I never really considered him to be like a heel. You know, the whole story there was he was trying to expose what a fraud Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff were. So it was like he was almost like a mole, like a phony heel, masquerading as a heel. But yeah, I mean, Sting, if I remember correctly, would rarely partake in any Main Event Mafia attacks on babyfaces. So it was very weird. I would not consider him to have ever been a heel. That's probably why it didn't work out, because he you know, they didn't commit to it, and then he just went back to being a babyface anyway. Jeremy from Chicago, I recently checked out the first three Sound Up podcasts that you ever did. You had quite a lot of interesting words about Benoit and the wellness policy. I did. And if anyone wants to check those out, by the way, the first 10 Sound Offs I ever recorded are now archived on our YouTube channel. Anyway, he says, the Benoit tragedy occurred in mid-2007, but by 2008, the show had quickly become a sterilized PG soap opera. Blood was gone, the arena setup was completely lifeless, and new yet unexciting characters began to take over the show. Was the Benoit tragedy the ultimate reason that the Ruthless Aggression era crashed and burned so quickly, or were there other factors at play? Did WWE need to shed its already toned-down violent sex and hard edge to appease those in the media who were already using the company as a target for their mudslinging? Let's say the Benoit tragedy never occurs. How is the show today? Similar, the same, or much different? The show is changing no matter what, because the world changed. Society changed. Everything is so damn PC now. There's no way in hell they'd ever get away with half the shit they did back then. So I don't think the product would look really any different today regardless. I think we would have ended up in the exact same place. Maybe it would have taken a little bit longer, but we would have ended up in the same PG place that we're in now. Did the Benoit stuff directly result in the birth of the PG era? No. But you can't say it didn't play a role. It did. It absolutely was part of it. It did play a role. But I don't think it's accurate to say that's what did it. The Benoit stuff happened in 2007. They didn't officially go PG for another full year. It was July 22nd, 2008. That was the official date that WWE went PG. I could have sworn they posted something about it on the WWE website itself at the time. Sure enough, I Googled it, and the news item is still up. It's a very brief announcement, but the headline is right there. WWE goes PG. And it was posted on July 22nd, 2008. Part of it, at least the part on banning blood, came about after that Shawn Michaels-Chris Jericho match at the last Great American Bash show, which I was there for. It was at the Nassau Coliseum. And Michaels bled a gusher during that match, just drenched in blood. That was when they were doing the angle with Jericho going after Shawn's injured eye, his lazy eye. That was the end of blading, at least officially, anyway. They wanted to expand their audience to reach a younger demographic. The Mattel deal came the following year. But the biggest reason, I believe, for the shift over to PG, the media scrutiny from Benoit absolutely played a part. Wanting more kids played a part, but it was Linda McMahon. It was Linda McMahon's political ambitions that played the biggest role. In September of 2009, I knew it was 09, I couldn't remember exactly what the month was. I looked it up. It was September of 09. Linda made the announcement that she was running for Senate. Don't think for a second that they weren't already exploring that as an idea in 2008. You don't just wake up out of bed one morning 3 months beforehand and say, hey, I think I'll run for Senate. There's a lot of planning that goes into it. There's a lot of discussions with other people, feeling them out. How would the party be, you know, how receptive would the party be if I wanted to run? All that kind of stuff, all the back, you know, behind the scenes stuff. They knew in 2008, they were already planning for it. And to do that, they had to clean up the company's image and become more kid friendly. That's why also a lot of content on YouTube started to disappear. The video used to be on YouTube, I remember. Vince McMahon, Trish Stratus, that infamous segment on Raw in 01 where he had Trish down on all fours barking like a dog. And that used to be on YouTube. Maybe since then somebody's put it back up. But for a few years anyway, it disappeared. They started scrubbing or having YouTube scrub a lot of that questionable content that could come back to bite them on the ass. Because all it would take is one political reporter to pull this shit up on YouTube and try to use it against Linda. I mean, that's what they did anyway. They constantly took the wrestling stuff and tried to use that against Linda McMahon. And, you know, you can make the argument that they had every right to do that because Linda, for how many years? She was the CEO of that company. She was deeply involved in that company, and she had to answer for all of that questionable content. But stuff started to disappear, and this was, you know, pretty far in advance. So they knew. And they wanted to clean up the image of their company and make it more advantageous for her when she made the announcement that she was going to run. So to this day, I believe that was the biggest reason they made the switch. And if you look at the timeline, it fits. Spencer from Louisville. I was watching WrestleMania 5, Hogan vs. Savage, and the whole time I was thinking, what if Hogan was a heel in this match and Savage was the face? Or even doing what they did at WrestleMania 6 with Warrior and have babyface versus babyface. What do you think? I think it could have worked. I think maybe their fear was it would split the crowd reaction or Savage might actually get more cheers. Savage was very successful as champion in 88. They did good business. He had a very successful house show run of title matches against Ted DiBiase. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe part of it was Hogan was worried about that. And I mean, look, they had their story planned far in advance that they were going to be a team, right? They had the alliance together, Hogan Savage, and Elizabeth would come between them and Savage would grow jealous. I mean, that was the story. So they followed that story through to the end. And I like that. That angle, that whole storyline is probably still to this day my favorite that they've ever done. And it was very successful and very lucrative for them. But I don't doubt that there probably was some fear that, hey, if we were to do something like that, more people might cheer for Savage than Hogan, you know, because you had to protect Hogan at all costs. Hogan was the golden goose. So, but, you know, do I think that match could have worked? Babyface versus babyface? Yeah, it could have made for a interesting dynamic. Lorenzo from Fresno. Buy or sell CM Punk's 434-day reign as WWE champion. You know, I'm going to sell. And there's something Hulk Hogan probably never said a day in his life. But I'm selling this. I like the pairing with Heyman, which only came in the last few months of his reign. I loved the matches with Daniel Bryan, especially that first match they had at, what was it? Over the Limit. It was the first in a series of three pay-per-view matches they had. That was a great wrestling match. But his run just never felt special to me. It's like the whole Nikki Bella thing. 295 days as Divas champion and counting. Who cares? 295 days of shit. I wouldn't call Punk's reign shit. That's not what I'm trying to say. But the majority of his reign as champion, he was relegated to the second or third match from the top. He was still playing second fiddle to John Cena and to The Rock. Even the night he won the title. And then again at WrestleMania. I mean, hell, you had a fucking pay-per-view headlined by John Cena against John Laurinaitis and Big Show's gazillionth heel turn. Even Johnny Ace got the headline over CM Punk. And it's not like his run is remembered for all these amazing classic matches that he had, aside from maybe the Bryan ones. He did have that great street fight with Jericho at Extreme Rules, much better than their WrestleMania match. Neither of which headlined those shows, by the way. And again, the Bryan program and the AJ Lee stuff. And what else? What else is there? Tell me what was so great about that 434-day reign. That it wasn't John Cena kept the belt off him? So what? Cena was still number one. Nothing changed. The real reign that had potential to be something special was that first run when he won the belt at Money in the Bank in 2011. That could have been something special, and they blew it. The second reign was a lot longer, but you know, as we've seen with the Divas title, quantity over quality does not mean a whole hell of a lot. Kind of like Raw. Just because you make the show longer does not make the show better. If anything, it makes the show worse. Jose from Brooklyn. Do you see John Cena or Roman Reigns tying Stone Cold Steve Austin with three Royal Rumble match victories? Yes, John Cena. I think John Cena will tie him. Steve from Derbyshire, England. I'd love to know your thoughts on The Rock's quick babyface tweener turn in the summer of 1998. He was getting Rocky Sucks chants every night since 97, then at Breakdown in 98, he got the biggest pop of the night against Mick Foley and Ken Shamrock. I actually think he got a bigger pop that night than Steve Austin. He became the number two babyface alongside Austin. I still think he should have won the championship at Survivor Series that year clean and remained babyface without the heel turn. But then again, he had a great heel run with the corporation. What do you think? I wouldn't change any of that. That corporate Rock is second only to Hollywood Rock as my favorite incarnation of The Rock. I just thought he was great. I wouldn't change a thing about it. And they did not need two top mega babyfaces like that. Stone Cold was the guy. Stone Cold had to have somebody else that he could chase as a heel at that level, and they really didn't have anybody like that. It wasn't Triple H, it wasn't Mankind, it wasn't Undertaker, although Undertaker, you know, was up there, but they needed that other guy that could go toe-to-toe with Austin, you know, verbally and in the ring, and just be a complete dick that the fans can, you know, want to see get his ass kicked. And The Rock was perfect. He was perfect in that role. And that just ignited the whole Austin versus Rock feud. I mean, they were already feuding to a degree, but then it blew up, you know, in 98 into 99. And was, you know, one of the more memorable rivalries in that company's history, so they must have done something right. So I wouldn't change a thing about it. I actually remember when that happened, when that turn, the fans turned in Rock's favor. It was that ladder match. It was that ladder match with Triple H at SummerSlam in 98. I think it earned both those guys a lot of respect, and it really hurt Triple H that he got injured. He fucked up his knee, had to forfeit the Intercontinental title. He was out of action for a few months. It really hurt his momentum, that injury. And it makes me wonder how different things might have been for him, just in terms of where, you know, his positioning at the time, and if he would have gotten the world title that much faster. Because when he pulled that title down at MSG in that ladder match, place went nuts. That was one of the pinnacles of his career, if not the pinnacle of his career at that point. And then he had to go away for a few months because he was hurt. But Rock, who lost that match, see, I don't know if people remember this or not, but back then, when a pay-per-view would go off the air, WWE had an agreement with the Home Shopping Network, and they would go live on the Home Shopping Network, and they would shill a whole bunch of WWE stuff. And so they were doing the broadcast, I guess, from the building that night, and The Rock came on set. This was after the ladder match. He had showered or whatever, and now he's on set, and he was great. I mean, he showed a side of his personality. He came off like a babyface. He showed a side of his personality we really hadn't seen before, but there was something going on. Like, that was the turn where people started to, you know, cheer him and chant his name. And I remember that Breakdown show. I think it was in Canada. And that was one of the better triple threat matches I've ever seen in WWE. Not the best, but it was one of the best. Rock, Mankind, Shamrock in the cage. Triple threat cage match. I haven't seen too many of those. When Rock came out, you're right. The place was just going nuts for this guy. And he really didn't do anything to turn heel or to turn babyface. I'm sorry. The fans turned him. The fans just naturally gravitated to this guy because he was so charismatic and so fun to watch, and his promos, they just became a fan of his. But they didn't need two mega baby faces on top. There's only room for one. But hey, if I turn, well, now I can work with Austin. Now I can work with the hot baby face. So it was a great position for Rock to be in. So you didn't need them. You didn't need two big baby faces on top like that. David from Coopersburg, Pennsylvania, has a buy or sell. Bret Hart in 1994 and John Cena in 2015. Both were champions in the face of WWE at a time when ratings were near record lows. Both were having great matches in those years and were probably wrestlers of the year. Bret won it in 94, and Cena should win it this year. Though they should not bear the sole blame, neither was able to increase the ratings as champion as the face of the company. Who do you think did a better job of keeping WWE relevant at a time when wrestling just wasn't as popular as it was after the heydays of Hulkamania for Bret and the Attitude Era for John Cena? It kills me to sell Bret in 94 because he was my favorite. If you asked me who my favorite wrestler of all time was, if I had to give you an answer, my answer would be Bret Hart. And I'm talking Bret Hart from that 1992 to 1994 period, primarily. But I've got a buy on John Cena here. Buy, 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 like a stock. Yeah, he may be down lately, but I'm making a hell of a lot more money with Cena stock than I am Bret stock back then. WWE is way, way more relevant in the mainstream now. It's not even close. Way more relevant than they were back in 1994. You know, those were the dark days. They were still reeling from all the steroid stuff. It was still going on in 94. That was when Vince got acquitted, I think, in July of that year. Bret was very popular when the company was much smaller than it is today. So I have to be careful when I compare him then and Cena now, because it's not an entirely fair comparison. But between those two periods, Cena's the man. You take him out of the equation and it hurts the live events, it hurts the merchandise sales, it hurts your image, because the guy is all over the place. He's done movies. He just hosted the Today Show for the third time, I think, last week. All the Make-A-Wish stuff. You know, the dude's got 7 million Twitter followers, whatever that means. Whatever that's worth, I guess. But that's a huge following that this guy has. I don't think Bret Hart, if you had Twitter back then, would have 7 million Twitter followers. And that means something to them. The social media stuff, I only bring that up because to them that's a big deal. Yeah, so you ask me, who did a better job of keeping WWE relevant? The answer is John Cena. You send him out in the media, they're all in love with the guy. You know, they don't know that he's overexposed. They don't care if he's playing politics for his girlfriend behind the scenes. They don't know that. They don't care. If you ask me now, who's the better wrestler? It's Bret. Who had the better matches? Bret. Who was more believable and realistic in the role? Bret. But that's everything we're not talking about here, so I have to buy on John Cena. It's a good question, though. It is a good question. All right, let's get to the first of what will be my list of 8 favorite WWE matches of mine that I have picked out. There's been a lot of great matches over the years, but in preparation of our 8-year anniversary in November. November 8th is going to mark the 8-year anniversary of this podcast. And so, starting now, and every single week between now and November 8th, I'm going to talk about a match. And this is in not any particular order. This is completely random. A list of 8 that I've put together. And what I'm actually going to do, I'm going to start with what probably is the most obvious one. I'm sure many of you are sitting there going, he's going to talk about the Royal Rumble again, aren't you? Well, you're goddamn right I am. The 1992 Royal Rumble. If I did have to rank a list, by the way, this probably would be number one, if I'm being perfectly honest with you, because this match just had everything that, yes, as a fan back then, even a fan now, it had everything that you would look for in a match, right? It told a great story. There was a lot of star power in there. It was great. The commentary was fantastic. You just can't get the total package like that today. You can get a great match, but shit commentary. You can have a match with great commentary and have a match full of nothing but botches and rest holds. It's like you can't get them all, like the stars aligned. But I feel like the stars aligned in this match. It was the 1992 Royal Rumble match, still to this day the only one that was ever contested for the WWE Championship, which was vacant at the time. I can't believe they never did that again. And it became difficult when they had two titles, because you couldn't really have the Royal Rumble for just one belt. So they almost couldn't even try that during the brand split era. Although now there's no excuse if they wanted to try it now. But let me just mention this, because I used to do a segment on this show called Match Anatomy. It was short-lived. I only did about 6 of them. But what it was effectively was I would pick a match. You guys would recommend a match. I would, pick it and then would talk about it. Pick it apart, analyze it, review it, talked about what made it great or what made it not so great. And so one of the Match Anatomies I did was on the 1992 Royal Rumble. So I've already talked about this at length. And if you want to go back, by the way, and listen to that Match Anatomy segment, you can do so. It's at the end of Sound Off, episode 202. So if you want to go back and check that out, you can. So I'm just going to make a few comments about it. I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but this is easily one of my favorite matches of all time, for all the reasons I just mentioned. And when you think back to the story they were telling in the match, The story was all about Ric Flair. Ric Flair was the new guy on the block. He had just come over from the NWA, had the fallout with Jim Herd and that whole controversy, brought the big gold belt with him, and so right from day one, the storyline was he, being Flair, is the real world champion, not Hulk Hogan. And that was kind of the fantasy match that people had talked about for years. What would happen one day if Hulk Hogan wrestled Ric Flair? And it looked like we were on that path. And they had a few house show matches in Madison Square Garden. They had a match, I think, in L.A. And they didn't do great. I think the first one or two may have sold out, did very well. But they took it on tour almost, which was probably a mistake. And people just weren't all that interested, I guess, in seeing Hulk Hogan against Ric Flair. And that had a little something to do with why Vince McMahon shied away from doing that match at WrestleMania 8, even though he probably should have. We never did get that big Hogan vs. Flair singles match on WWF television before they had their... I guess it would have been, what, Bash at the Beach, 1994? That was the first big pay-per-view meeting between Hogan and Flair, and WCW did a very good buy rate for that match. So, while they were telling the story of Flair as the real world's champion, to validate his claim, what better way than to win the WWE Championship? Hogan had the title stripped from him. It was put up in the Rumble match. And just, you look at the roster of talent they had. Ric Flair, Hulk Hogan, Randy Savage, Sergeant Slaughter, Sid Justice, Roddy Piper. Shawn Michaels was in there. A young Shawn Michaels, but it's still cool to see him in there, hanging with the top stars. He had just turned heel. So this was the first, the original incarnation of the Heartbreak Kid. British Bulldog was in there. I know I'm missing some other big names, and I'm like pissed now. DiBiase was in there, Jake the Snake, Undertaker. Ton of people were in this Rumble match. And Flair came out at number three. They made it very clear. Nobody had ever entered the Rumble that early and been there at the end. So if that had happened today, that's what we call foreshadowing. I don't know that when I was, what would I have been? 10 years old, probably? Something like that. I probably didn't know that from anything. Although I've told the story before, I was in school and recess and the kids were huddled in a phone booth and I didn't know what was going on. It turned out they were calling a wrestling hotline. That used to be the big thing back in the day, wrestling hotlines instead of, websites. And they came out of the phone booth and they were like, Ric Flair's going to win the Royal Rumble. And I'm like, how the hell did they know that? So I looked like a genius when I sat down with my grandfather and my family to watch the Rumble and they asked me, who do you think's going to win? And I said, Ric Flair. And they're like, you're crazy. And I wasn't crazy. But the thing with Flair was, it wasn't just that he had an issue with Hulk Hogan. He also had an issue with Roddy Piper. It was like these dual angles they were doing. And again, oddly enough, he never had that big TV or pay-per-view match with Piper. It was very weird. Like, they started these feuds with Flair, and they never followed up on them. And I think, looking back on it now, it just comes across to me as a huge wasted opportunity. But Flair was picking fights left and right with some of the top guys when he first came in. And Flair makes it to the halfway point. The ring is empty. Heenan's on commentary. Just give him the title. Monsoon's like, I'm not giving him the title. And they have the countdown clock, and out comes Piper and the look on Flair's face. It was priceless. So on we go, and everyone's trying to dump Flair out of the ring, and like a cockroach, he keeps coming back. And just the way the whole thing was set up, it was probably the brainchild of Pat Patterson, was just genius. And then even the finish. Sid Justice had been brought in as a babyface. He dumps Hogan out of the ring. And Hogan just comes across as the biggest whiny little crybaby bitch that you've ever seen. What did you do, brother? I thought we were friends. And Sid looks at him and goes, it's every man for himself, big boy. And he's right. It's every man for himself. But Hogan he couldn't fathom what had just happened. So when Sid turns around to turn his attention to Flair to win, Hogan reaches up and grabs his arm. He's not letting go. And Hogan ends up helping Ric Flair dump Sid Justice out of the ring. Like a true heel. I still maintain, I've said this before, Hogan was a heel. People just didn't know it. Look at every single one of his matches. Eye rakes. Back scratches. The guy was a heel. Look what he did to poor Randy Savage. He drove the guy nuts for an entire year. He would grab the guy's wife and celebrate with her. people said, oh, Savage is just too overprotective. No, you know what? I think in that storyline, Hulk Hogan knew exactly what he was doing. The guy was nothing but a troublemaker. So anyway, the finish was great, and Flair wins the championship. It's just one of those things that you look back on now, and it wasn't overly complicated. It was so simple. It was such a simple story to tell. They had certain goals that they had to meet. They had this new guy. I mean, he was already a huge star, but in WWE, he was brand new. They wanted to get this new guy over. How do you make him look strong? Well, today, they'd give you a fucking briefcase, and they'd beat you every single week because, well, he's got the briefcase, right? So who cares? That's their idea of getting people over, and then they wonder why people don't get over. What a concept. Back in 1992, we have this new guy who wasn't even a WWE guy, and they had every reason, you know, as their mentality is, to probably make him look bad because he's not one of our guys. But no, they put him over strong. They sent him out there early. He had this great Iron Man performance. By the end, people cheered when he won. Partially because some people hated Hogan. That's why they cheered when he got dumped out of the ring by Sid. But part of it was Ric Flair had earned their respect. He didn't have to cheat. He won. He won fair and square. So they got the new guy over. They told multiple stories in the match. And it wasn't just involving Flair, too. Well, one thing I didn't mention is the Randy Savage, Jake Roberts story. One of my favorite storylines in WWE history was the angle they did in 1991 and the snake bite and him assaulting Elizabeth at that Tuesday in Texas special and then Savage having this meltdown backstage afterward. So Jake is out there. Savage comes out. Savage is looking for Jake. And Jake disappears. So you have these other stories that are playing themselves out as the match goes on. The Flair-Piper story, because they had an issue. It wasn't just Flair and Hogan. Undertaker. Undertaker was, allied with Jake Roberts. So when Savage came out, Undertaker went after Savage. He was trying to help Jake. So there was a lot of that going on during the match. Even the Bulldog. They mentioned at the beginning, Bulldog was number one, I think, in the Rumble. And they said the guy had just won a big battle royal in November at the Royal Albert Hall. They had this big event in the UK. It was like a 40-man battle royal. And Bulldog won. He won like the Samovar Trophy or whatever they called it. And they mentioned that at the beginning of the Rumble. So even the Bulldog, who was, you know, like a mid-card guy at the time, they're saying, hey, this guy just won a battle royal a couple of months ago. He may win it all. You know, Piper just won the Intercontinental Championship on the undercard from the Mountie. The story there was, is Roddy Piper going to leave with two titles? Can he become the first person in history, which he wouldn't have been, but I guess they were ignoring the Warrior. But they did make that comment at one point that he would be the first to hold both belts. Could he do it? Could he win the WWF Championship after winning the IC title? And that's just one of the things I just absolutely love about that Royal Rumble match. Lots of stories, big names. Heenan, his finest hour, which is saying a lot because Heenan and Monsoon are my all-time favorite announced duo. And that was, I think, together, both of their greatest hour. It was, you know, they could be funny, and then they could be dramatic, and then, you know, Monsoon would browbeat Heenan, as he was prone to do. Heenan had so many great one-liners in this match. I think there was one point where Flair gave Undertaker a low blow, or maybe somebody gave Duggan a low blow. Something happened, and I think Heenan, he said something to the effect of, he tried to lift him out of the ring. He's like, he did not. And then there's another line about the Barbarian when he came out, who Heenan used to manage. I mean, Heenan managed everybody except Hogan, and the Barbarian came out, and again, so he went from being funny one moment, now he's trying to build up the drama of all these big, tough guys that are coming in, and he's talking about the Barbarian and how, you know, they don't call him the Barbarian for nothing. It's not like he's a hairdresser on his day off. He goes, the Barbarian doesn't like anybody. When I managed him, he barely liked me. And Heenan's talking about the importance of winning this match and the championship, and you got to just do everything that you can possibly do. Do whatever it takes to get the win. He goes, I'd do that to my grandmother if I had to. And it was just great. I can't say enough good things about this match. And it's part of it is nostalgia when I say that there will never be another Rumble match that tops this. But a big part of it is I just don't have any faith that they would ever be able to get that magic formula, like recreate the magic they had that night for anything that they you know, could think of to do in the Rumble. Look at the last 2 years of the Rumble. Part of it is the fans, you know, have sabotaged it. But ask yourself, why have the fans sabotaged the Royal Rumble? Not just because they're trying to be dicks, because they were rebelling against shitty booking. You know, poor Big Dave Batista back in 2014, it wasn't his fault, but they took it out on him. They took it out on Rey Mysterio. It's not Rey's fault. So WWE just has to be smarter with how they you know, book the Royal Rumble. Royal Rumble was always one of my favorite events. And the last 2 years have just been hijacked. But they got to ask themselves, why? Why was it hijacked? What are we doing wrong? What could we be doing better? With the Rumble, you know, keep it simple, stupid. You don't have to overthink things. You get a couple of good stories. Put some big names in there. Give people some surprises. And whatever you do, don't clear Daniel Bryan to come back until the day after the Royal Rumble. That's probably the best piece of advice I can give them. Because if the people don't think he's going to be in that match, they might have a fighting shot of not shitting all over it. So next week, we will keep the countdown going. We'll have match number 2 for my 8 favorites in WWE history. I think it's a good selection that I've narrowed it down to. And like I said earlier, all but one of these matches that I've chosen are available on the network right now. So if you've never seen them before, if you want to see them again, you can just log on there. You can watch it anytime you want to. All but one. There is one match, unfortunately, that is not currently available on the network. But the rest are. And so we'll do match number 2 next week, and we'll do another match every single week, building up to the 8-year anniversary show on November 8th. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can email me, thesolomonster, @gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @solomonster. I'll be live tweeting during the Night of Champions pay-per-view tonight, as I always do for the pay-per-views and for Raw. If you want to commiserate with me during Raw on Monday night, you can do so on there as well. We have our YouTube channel up and running and lots of good content up there, including the very first 10 episodes ever recorded of The Sound Off from 2007 to 2008. You can go to youtube.com/thesolomonster, hit the subscribe button. I just wanted to give a quick update on something else before we wrap up here. A lot of you have been asking me for updates on my mom. I talked about what happened, a lot of the family strife and shit that's been going on. And then I really haven't talked about it since then. And some people were worried by that. There's nothing to be worried about. Things are just moving along. She's doing very well. So far, so good. You know, she's working and moving on with her life. She's on her medication, including, remember, I think I told you guys about the $11,000 per month pill that they wanted to put her on, which is just unbelievable. So thankfully, we were able to work out that situation. She's getting it for about $80 a month now. So she's on that, and she's taken well to it so far. It's kind of a weird drug, in a way, in that it was just approved by the FDA in, like, April. So it's brand new. And you take it in tandem with something else. You don't take it alone. And the idea is that this new pill, what it does, in theory, is it extends the effectiveness of the primary pill, the primary medication that she's on. So it should keep it working for a longer period of time. That's the hope. Anything to keep us away from chemo and all that nasty stuff, which is probably inevitable, but the longer we could stay away from that, the better. And it's been 2 months that she's been on that new drug, and so far so good. It was some pretty scary side effects that we had read about and heard about, but, you know, knock on wood, so far she hasn't really been touched by that. So things are just rolling along. There really isn't much else to report. You know, we have our checkups every other week just to make sure things are in check. And so far, so good. So thank you to everybody who has asked. That's really cool. I appreciate that. I'll try to give updates, not every week, but a little more often than I was. So thank you for reminding me about that. But yeah, so far, so good. We will be back for episode 402 next weekend. So until then, be well, stay safe. And we'll see you right back here again for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the Ugly. The Sala Monster sounds off.
Watch these promos on NXT. Watch Raw. Watch a Randy Orton promo or a Sheamus promo. They never, ever look at the camera. It's because that's what they teach them now. You are not allowed to look into the camera. I think it's just completely idiotic. Why are their eyes not on me? That's how interviews always work. They're talking to me. They're speaking to us. They're supposed to be speaking to the fans. Maybe that's part of the reason why these people can't make a connection with the audience. Because they don't fucking look at us.
The Monster sounds off.
Since 2007, The Sala Monster sounds off. Available at thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monsters sound off.